welcome you all here today to John Lacken's talk on Ireland pre and post contraception. Any of you who know John, he's married to Naomi. They were married in 1988 and they're blessed with 8 children. He's founder of Legio Sanctae Familiae, the Legion of the Holy Family. And John has been writing about Catholic marriage and family life for the Catholic Voice for almost 3 years now. He presents the traditional Catholic family on Radio Maria Ireland on Friday afternoons. Without further ado, I hand you over to John.
In the name of the Father and of the Son, amen. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Genesis 1, 1-3. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. John 1, 1-5. My name is John Lacken, and Patrick asked me to come here today to speak about the history of contraception in Ireland and the Catholic response to it. I'm married to Naomi. We've been blessed with 8 children, all of whom were delivered by cesarean section. I received another unusual blessing, which I did not recognize for many years. And that is, I have never attended university in Ireland. I don't have any degrees. I trained as a chef. I can do a bit with computers, though I'm no expert. And I'm currently unemployed. And at my age, I'm 54. It's not easy to find work, especially when you don't have a proper qualification. Sometimes, and you may be surprised at this, people come up to me and say, "You know, John, you're great. Going to confession every week, Mass every day, homeschooling your children, writing about marriage, etc., etc." I don't find this particularly helpful because I know who I am and I'm painfully aware of my own sinfulness. As I get older, I recognize why, when the woman caught in adultery was brought to Jesus and he said, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone," that it was the oldest who went away first. They had clocked up more sins. Each time I go to confession, I begin, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned." And then I confess my sins. I have never yet said to the priest, "No sins this week, Father." I cannot even go for 1 week without offending God in some way or other. And this helps me to realize that only God is good. And the only thing that I have of my own to give Him are my sins in confession. I was in Rome in May of this year, and I was rubbing shoulders with the world leaders in the pro-life movement at the Roma Life Conference. I noticed the seed of pride being born in my heart, thinking, I too could be like these great leaders, could be one of their number promoting the family, as good as any of them. Hey, maybe even better than some of them. As soon as I recognized the threat, I prayed against it, asking God in the tabernacle for humility. Now, experience has taught me that when you ask God if you dare for humility, He will sometimes send you an unexpected humiliation. The way of humility proceeds by the path of humiliations. And so my plans for the Sunday in Rome fell through, and I was left alone in Rome, feeling useless and also feeling very sorry for myself. I went back to the guest house where I was staying, which was run by nuns, and there was a chapel on the floor that I was staying. So I went in to pray the chaplet to Our Lady of Sorrows. And I received great peace during the meditation on Our Lady's Sorrows. And then I realized that I am indeed useless, that I am nothing. But at the same time, I also realized that the work of promoting the traditional Catholic family is a most important work, one of the most important works ever given by God to man. I realized that it is first and foremost God's work, not mine, and that it would seem that indeed God wants me to promote this work for Him, but on His terms, not mine. And so if you find anything that I may have to say today inspiring or enlightening, or that it stirs up hope in your heart and gives you courage, then please give thanks to God for this gift that he has given to me, his most unworthy servant. And please pray that I may one day rise from my sins and enter into glory with God in heaven to sing the divine praises with the heavenly hosts forever and ever. Amen. On the other hand, if you find anything objectionable or useless in this talk, well, that's my worthless contribution, so please keep praying for me. Now, do any of you know Patrick McChrystal? He's an incredible man. He's the only pro-life man I know who invites you to Mass, tells you to put on a Choose Life t-shirt, and then tries to kill you by making you climb 2,500 feet up a rocky mountain in the mist and the wind and the rain for the Mass and the church at the top. I'm only joking if Patrick is here. But I did indeed climb Crowpatrick last month with Patrick and 22 other men in the mist and the wind and the rain. This is the second time I've done this climb, and I get great benefit from it. It's a climb of reparation for men. And I tend to avoid others and not to talk on the way up. It's nothing personal. It's just I have a lot of reparation to make for my sins. And at my age, the upward climb is tough, and I need to stay focused on why I am there. On the way back down this year, I had a little insight which is very relevant to life in the church today. The mist was quite heavy as I began my descent, and at times you could barely see 10 feet in front of you. People ahead looked like moving shadows. And the thought struck me that it would be quite easy to get lost in the mist. You couldn't really see where you were going. The destination was lost to sight. You couldn't see down the mountain. But then it struck me. You must follow closely the path just visible ahead. But what is the path? The path is the way of those who have gone before and have reached the destination. I realize that this is also the way for Catholics. We too must follow the path of those who have gone before us, and this path goes under the name of tradition and history. I grew up just about 2 miles from here. And in my own life, in my late teens, I drifted away from the practice of my faith and ended up living an immoral life. I didn't go to Mass or confession for years. Thank God, the unhappiness of this lifestyle led me to search for that deeper meaning, which I knew instinctively must exist. And I came back to the practice of my Catholic faith about 2 years before I got married. I became very interested in what the Church teaches and in reading more and more about Catholicism, partly to strengthen my own faith, and partly to try to find out why so many of my generation were abandoning the faith. To give you an idea of what it was like in this part of Dublin, and this is the most liberal part of Dublin, a former girlfriend of mine was heading away to America for a year back around 1982 or 1983. The group of us that hung out together, we decided to take a photograph of all of us, mounted on wood, and present it to her as a parting gift. There were about 30 of us in the photo. Of that 30, only 2 were still going to Mass every week. That's less than 7%, and that's over 30 years ago. It has not gotten better since. One of the things I have noticed on this journey is a particular insistence among certain Catholics on the Second Vatican Council and what it supposedly taught. Last year, I began a course on marriage and family evangelization with a renowned Catholic institute, and I began to notice certain things that did not sit well with me. They stated that the Second Vatican Council gave a new description of marriage. They also taught us, and I quote, "In summary, the Church now speaks of 2 purposes of Christian marriage, the love between the spouses and their openness to create and educate new life. It is a both and notion. Neither is given priority over the other," unquote. This contradicted my own research on what the Church teaches about marriage, and particularly about the primary end of marriage. Why did this contradiction exist? Who was right? Who was telling the truth? So I did a simple mathematical equation. We're in the year 2016. That's 2016 years since the birth of Christ. If Christ lived for 33 years, then the Catholic Church has existed for 1,983 years, 2016 minus 33. The Second Vatican Council began on the 11th of October 1962, the year that I was born. We're now in 2016. which is 54 years since the council. 54 years represents just under 3% of Catholic Church history. Or if we invert the figures, we will find that just over 97% of Catholic Church history and teaching took place before the Second Vatican Council. Now, this is not to deny anything of the Second Vatican Council, but simply to put it into perspective from the point of view of church teaching. What was true before the council remains true after the council. Even though there are many within the church who seek to deny or to change certain teachings, particularly with regard to marriage and family life, Catholic history and Catholic tradition are the roots and foundation on which the faith is built and lived, and we ignore or discard them at our peril. And so when you hear people saying that since the Second Vatican Council, the church now teaches or now believes, as if some new belief has been discovered, remember Paul's word to the Galatians: if anyone comes and preaches a gospel different to what we preached, do not listen to them. Remember Christ's words in Matthew 7 and Matthew 24, where he tells us, beware of false prophets, and that many false prophets will come and lead many astray, all the while claiming to be speaking for Christ. Do not allow yourselves to be led astray. Follow the path of those who have gone before. Before looking at contraception, therefore, it is important that we understand the primary end of marriage, which simply put is children. I open this talk by quoting St. John's Gospel in the book of Genesis. Father Bouquet mentioned it in his sermon. Let us go back now to the first chapter of the book of Genesis, to the first account of the creation of man. When the Pharisees tried to trap Jesus on the question of divorce, this is where he directs them to. When Pope St. John Paul II began what became known as the theology of the body, this is where he started. How was it in the beginning? And God said, let us make man to our image and likeness. Let him have dominion over the fishes of the sea and the fowls of the air and the beasts and the whole earth and every creeping creature that moveth upon the earth. And God created man to his own image, to the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. And God blessed them, saying, increase and multiply and fill the earth. Genesis 1, 26 to 28. Increase and multiply and fill the earth. The first words of God recorded in the Bible spoken to man. This is before the fall, so there's no disunity or disharmony between the man and the woman. And here God gives the primary end of marriage. And because it is God who gives it, it cannot and can never change. Pope Pius XII, in his address to midwives on October 29th, 1951, expressed it this way. Now the truth is that matrimony as an institution of nature, in virtue of the Creator's will, has not as the primary and intimate end the personal perfection of the married couple, but the procreation and upbringing of a new life. The other ends, inasmuch as they are intended by nature, are not equally primary, much less superior to the primary end, but are essentially subordinated to it. This is true of every marriage, even if no offspring result. Just as of every eye it can be said that it is destined and formed to see, even if in abnormal cases arising from special internal or external conditions, it will never be possible to achieve visual perception. He then continues, it was precisely to end the uncertainties and deviations which threatened to diffuse errors regarding the scale of values of the purposes of matrimony and of the reciprocal relations that a few years ago, it was March the 10th, 1944, we ourselves drew up a declaration on the order of those ends, pointing out what the very internal structure of the natural disposition reveals. We showed what has been handed down by Christian tradition, what the supreme pontiffs have repeatedly taught, and what was then in due measure promulgated by the code of canon law. Not long afterwards, to correct opposing opinions, the Holy See, by a public decree, proclaimed that it could not admit the opinion of some recent authors who denied that the primary end of marriage is the procreation and education of the offspring, or who teach that the secondary ends are not essentially subordinated to the primary end, but are on an equal footing and independent of it. Unquote. As I just mentioned, 64 years after this papal statement, in 2015, a reputable Catholic institute taught me in a course that I was doing that in summary the Church now speaks of two purposes of Christian marriage and that neither is given priority over the other. This directly contradicts Church teaching. And Pope Pius XII was careful to note that the view he expressed was handed down by Christian tradition, that it was repeatedly taught by supreme pontiffs, that it was promulgated in the code of canon law, and that it was supported by a public decree of the Holy See. In doing this, he was pointing to the infallible nature of the teaching. When I pointed this out in my essay for the course, I was given 0 marks and told that I would have to rewrite my essay. The course director in an email said to me, quote, "You are perfectly entitled to your own views and opinions, but this course is preparing students to engage in the Church's mission of evangelization and ministry, so it is necessary for us to see evidence that they faithfully echo the faith of the Church." How ironic is that? This is a distortion of the Second Vatican Council, and the reason I tell you this is to show you what is going on now within the Church. Now you may be wondering what all of this has to do with contraception. But it is only when you realize and accept that the primary end of marriage is children, a teaching which has not been taught in the Western world for years, and that is in fact contradicted by many prominent Catholics, it's only when you realize and accept this that you also realize the gravity of the offense against God that contraception constitutes. Contraception is primarily an attack against God because it attacks and contradicts the primary end for which he established marriage for all time, to bring children into existence who will become heirs to the kingdom of God. Christ is denied the existence of adoptive brothers and sisters who will give glory to God for all eternity through the use and practice of contraception. We have abortion, divorce, legal same-sex relationships, contraception, family breakdown, corrupting sex education programs for children in our Catholic schools, child abuse, pornography, immodesty, impurity, and other similar issues. None of these is the problem. They are all symptoms of the core problem. And the core problem will remain with us for as long as we keep addressing the symptoms without directly addressing the core problem. The core problem is that the world has forgotten, and many in the Church have forgotten, are allowed to lapse into the semi-conscious void, the answer to a question that was posed about 2,000 years ago by a group of men who may have been seeking to justify or to congratulate themselves. Let us look at this in St. Matthew's Gospel. This is the beginning of chapter 18, and here is the question. At that hour, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who thinkest thou is the greater in the kingdom of heaven?" You already know the answer, but let's listen to it again to pick up the nuances. And Jesus, calling to him a little child, set him in the midst of them and said, "Amen, I say to you, unless you be converted and become as little children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, he is the greater in the kingdom of heaven. And he that shall receive one such little child in my name receiveth me. But he that shall scandalize one of these little ones that believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone should be hanged around his neck and that he should be drowned in the depth of the sea." This is Christ speaking. "Woe to the world because of scandals. For it must needs be that scandals come. But nevertheless, woe to the man by whom the scandal cometh. And if thy hand or thy foot scandalize thee, cut it off and cast it from thee. It is better for thee to go into life maimed or lame than having 2 hands or 2 feet to be cast into everlasting fire. And if thy eye scandalize thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. It is better for thee having 1 eye to enter into life than having 2 eyes to be cast into hellfire." See that you despise not one of these little ones. For I say to you that their angels in heaven always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. Matthew 18:1-10. If you do not become like a child, you will not enter heaven. To welcome children is to welcome Jesus. Woe to those who would lead children astray. Woe to those who would deny children their very existence by promoting or practicing contraception. So how did we end up here? Consider the following statement and try to place where it came from. We utter an emphatic warning against the use of unnatural means for the avoidance of conception, together with the grave dangers, physical, moral, and religious, thereby incurred, and against the evils with which the extension of such use threatens the race. In opposition to the teaching, which under the name of science and religion encourages married people in the deliberate cultivation of sexual union as an end in itself, we steadfastly uphold what must always be regarded as the governing considerations of Christian marriage. One is the primary purpose for which marriage exists, primary purpose again, namely the continuation of the race through the gift and heritage of children. The other is the paramount importance in married life of deliberate and thoughtful self-control. We desire solemnly to commend what we have said to Christian people and to all who will hear. Anybody know which Pope said that? It's a trick question. That was Resolution 68 of the Lambeth Conference of 1920. And it shows that the entire Christian world upheld Catholic teaching on marriage right up until the next Lambeth Conference of 1930, which would permit the use of contraception to married couples, thereby allowing the dam to be breached at the cost of countless millions of human lives. In 1920, European society was recovering from a world war which began on the 28th of July 1914 and lasted until the 11th of November 1918, and which saw some 16 million people killed. There was a lot of poverty in the larger cities, and in London, a woman called Mary Stopes sought in part to tackle poverty by opening a birth control clinic in 1921. On the far side of the Atlantic, another woman named Margaret Sanger, who had met Mary Stopes in 1915 in London, was also involved in setting up a birth control movement, which eventually became the largest abortion provider in America, Planned Parenthood. Mary Stopes sent a pamphlet which she had written, promoting artificial birth control, to the Anglican bishops at their Lambeth Conference, called A New Gospel to All Peoples. In this pamphlet she said, "My lords, I speak to you in the name of God. You are his priests and I am his prophet. I speak to you of the mysteries of man and woman." Mary Stopes realized that she needed the support of the Anglican bishops in order to promote her birth control movement in England. 10 years later, that support would come. And interestingly, in Resolution 15 of the Lambeth Conference of 1930, which permitted contraception, they stated that the primary and obvious method of limiting or avoiding parenthood was abstinence from the marital act. But they then went on to give permission for contraception to be used by married couples. The victory wasn't achieved without opposition, and the Anglican Bishop of Oxford, Bishop Charles Gore, tried to rally the troops in an effort to get the decision reversed. But the absolute power of the democratic system by which the Anglicans were governed ensured that he would have no chance of prevailing. I will tell you why the Catholic Church is not a democracy. Bishop Gore responded to those Anglican bishops who expressed the opinion that the Anglican Church had placed the balance definitely on the side of strictness, saying, quote, "I fear that this is practically the exact opposite of the truth. I think the clause which sanctions certain methods as a regrettable necessity in certain cases, to use the bishop's expression, is the only clause which is likely to have any considerable effect. And I cannot doubt that that effect would be disastrous." His words were prophetic. Bishop Gore died on the 17th of January, 1932. Pope Pius XI, who was Pope at the time, did not want to let the sun set on that year without responding to the change that had been brought in at the Lambeth Conference. On December the 31st, the last day of the year 1930, he issued the encyclical letter Casti Canubi on Christian marriage to protect Christ's flock from the many predators who were peddling falsehoods concerning marriage. Here are some quotes. First consideration is due to the offspring. Why? Primary end of marriage, which many have the boldness to call the disagreeable burden of matrimony, and which they say is to be carefully avoided by married people, not through virtuous continence, which Christian law permits in matrimony when both parties consent, but by frustrating the marital act. Casti Canubi 53. He then goes on to restate Catholic teaching on this matter. But no reason, however grave, may be put forward by which anything intrinsically against nature may become conformable to nature and morally good. Since, therefore, the conjugal act is destined primarily by nature for the begetting of children, those who in exercising it deliberately frustrate its natural power and purpose, sin against nature and commit a deed which is shameful and intrinsically vicious. Casti Canubi 54. To remove any doubt as to the infallible nature of this doctrine and the gravity of this sin, Pope Pius XI continues, since therefore, openly departing from the uninterrupted Christian tradition, some recently have judged it possible solemnly to declare another doctrine regarding this question, the Catholic Church, to whom God has entrusted the defense of the integrity and purity of morals, standing erect in the midst of the moral ruin which surrounds her, in order that she may preserve the chastity of the nuptial union from being defiled by this foul stain, raises her voice in token of her divine ambassadorship, and through our mouth proclaims anew, any use whatsoever of matrimony, exercised in such a way that the act is deliberately frustrated in its natural power to generate life, is an offense against the law of God and of nature, and those who indulge in such are branded with the guilt of a grave sin. Casti Canubi 56. Fast forward past the Second World War to the year 1960. The Food and Drugs Administration of America approved the world's first commercially produced birth control pill, Inovid 10, on May the 10th, 1960. In 1963, Pope St. John the 23rd set up a commission to study the issues of birth control and population due to the growing popularity of the pill. He died in 1963 and was succeeded by Blessed Pope Paul VI, who expanded the membership of this commission from 6 to 72 people. In 1966, the commission produced a report which was leaked to the press, allegedly showing a majority in favor of changing the church's position on contraception. And I say allegedly because the official report has never been made public. A minority report was also produced, and it too was leaked to the press, arguing that the teaching could not change. The effect of the first leak was that it created the impression amongst many in the church that the teaching on contraception was about to be liberalized. One English priest recently wrote that after his own studies, he became convinced that there would be a change in church teaching, and that he supported his bishop in preparing the clergy of their diocese for such a change and offered pastoral guidance to them. In Ireland, too, there was a rumor abroad that church laws on contraception were about to be changed. Then came the fateful day, July the 25th, 1968, and the encyclical Humanae Vitae, which restated the church's ban on all contraceptive use. The English priest mentioned above says that Humanae Vitae came as a great shock to him. He was not the only one in the ranks of the clergy who were shocked. And shortly after the release of the encyclical, there arose in many parts of the world coordinated groups of clergy who protested and refused to accept the teachings of the encyclical. The situation in Ireland was similar, and it is very interesting, although difficult because of the sadness of the situation, to examine what happened here, because there are lessons to be learned, particularly in regard to the exercise of authority. Authority, when badly exercised in the church, causes huge damage to the faith of ordinary Catholics. It undermines the role and the influence of the bishops. It fails to stop dissent in its tracks, with the result that dissent tends to spread to epidemic proportions, and the ordinary people no longer know what to believe or where to find the truth. Faith becomes a matter of opinion. The concept of absolute truth is abandoned, and the sheep are scattered and left at the mercy of the wolves. Now, when Patrick asked me to give this talk, he wanted me to name names. But I'm not going to mention any names, as I want to focus on the deeds of men rather than the men of deeds. Focusing on the men distracts from the problem and can lead to detraction. I also cannot cast any stones on account of my own sins, on account of the plank in my own eye, which I'm still working to clear. For those who are interested in finding out more, it's not hard in this age of information technology. Let us first look to Ireland's National Seminary, St. Patrick's College, Maynooth. In the years following Humanae Vitae, at least 6 professors in the college, all of them priests, and 2 of them lecturers in moral theology, publicly dissented from the encyclical. None of them were disciplined, and none of them were dismissed. One of the professors gave a talk to the Irish Medical Union in which he contradicted church teaching on contraception. His archbishop issued a pastoral letter on November the 25th, 1970, which was to be read out in all the churches of his diocese, refuting this professor's errors in an attempt to address the problem that was being caused by the dissenters. This is just 2 years after Humanae Vitae. He said, "Accordingly, to correct the confusion that has been caused in the minds of the faithful of this diocese, we hereby formally declare the doctrine of the objective moral law concerning the regulation of birth. Every action which either in the anticipation of the marriage act, or in the accomplishment of that act, or in the development of the natural consequences of that act, proposes, either as an end or as a means, to make procreation impossible, is unlawful in itself." In other words, any contraceptive act is wrong in itself. This is the constant teaching of the church. This is the teaching recently reaffirmed by the Pope, supreme teacher of the law of God in the Church of Christ. Unquote. This archbishop resigned in 1971, and he died in 1973. And with his death, the last Episcopal voice in this country to directly challenge the dissenting professors in Maynooth became silent. Remember that these dissenting professors were teaching and training men for the priesthood, and they did not uphold the infallible church teaching on marriage and family life. And this dissent continues in the Maynooth Seminary to this very day. This is what we are up against. And the Lord said, "Because this people draw near me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, while their hearts are far from me, and their fear of me is a commandment of men learned by rote." Isaiah 29:13. The Irish bishops issued pastoral letters and statements which in their essence upheld the teachings of the Catholic Church, but their actions did not conform to those statements. There was a worrying disparity between the two, which seemed to indicate a nod and a wink in the direction of a subtle approval of contraception. Another Irish solution to another problem, perhaps? We shall see. The landmark change in the civil arena in Ireland came about in 1973 with the Supreme Court decision in McGee versus the Attorney General, which held that the state, by unreasonably restricting the availability of contraceptives for use within marriage through the ban on their importation, was acting unconstitutionally. One very interesting aspect of this case comes from the arguments submitted on behalf of the woman at the center of the case. It is noted that she and her husband were Roman Catholic, but, quote, "the plaintiff also says that her decision to practice contraception is in accordance with the dictates of her own conscience," unquote. That's from Justice Fitzgerald CJ's reading in McGee versus the Attorney General. This is the very same line of reasoning that was being put forward by the dissenting professors of moral theology in Maynooth, whereby in essence they claimed that Catholics could contravene the law of God so long as they were following the dictates of their own conscience. Man's conscience was superior to God's laws. In 1978, the then Minister for Health, who went on to become Taoiseach, signals his intention to finally deal with the matter. In April of that year, the Irish Bishops' Conference issued a statement, and in June of that year, a private meeting was held between 4 of Ireland's bishops and the Minister for Health to discuss the matter. I have obtained a copy of the bishop's statement, and it makes for sad reading. The bishops began with a brief paragraph on the church's moral teaching on artificial contraception, stating that no one can, by passing a law, make what is wrong in itself become right. This teaching is binding on the consciences of Catholics. This was immediately followed in paragraph 3 by this amazing sentence, quote, "It does not necessarily follow from this that the state is bound to prohibit the distribution and sale of contraceptives." The sentence was qualified, but even with the qualifications, it is impossible to reconcile this sentence with Catholic teaching. When one reads the rest of the bishop's statement in light of this particular sentence, it becomes clear that whilst on the surface it appears to uphold Catholic Church teaching, it is in fact an outline for the government as to what conditions they must satisfy in order for the bishops not to oppose the proposed legislation. The statement was a blueprint for the legislation. Nowhere does the bishop's statement offer any objection to the proposed legislation, and their statement ignored the teachings of previous popes on this matter. For example, Pope Leo XIII, in his encyclical Immortale Dei, states, "In political affairs and all matters civil, the laws aim at securing the common good and are not formed according to the delusive caprices and opinions of the mass of the people, but by truth and by justice. The ruling powers are invested with a sacredness more than human and are withheld from deviating from the path of duty and from overstepping the bounds of rightful authority. And the obedience is not the servitude of man to man, but submission to the will of God, exercising his sovereignty through the medium of men." Immortale Dei 18. No one is permitted to legislate for something which is intrinsically evil. Yet the Irish Bishop's Statement of 1978 gave tacit permission to the Irish government to permit the sale of contraceptives by saying that they were not bound to prohibit their sale and distribution. This is contrary to church teaching. The minister duly complied with the bishop's wishes, and in February of 1979, the phrase "an Irish solution to an Irish problem" was born, with the publication of the Health and Family Planning Act 1979, which lifted the ban, albeit with restrictions, on the sale and importation of contraceptives in Ireland. The minister also kindly provided funding for the Catholic Marriage Advisory Council to carry out research into natural family planning. One cannot help arriving at the conclusion that a deal was done which involved a monetary exchange. And now that the government were funding the Catholic Marriage Advisory Council, they were gaining the power to manipulate the organization through the threat of withholding funds, a tactic which was very effectively used in last year's referendum when the state withdrew funding from Accord after the bishops issued a weak statement upholding marriage. One brave professor in Maynooth spoke out publicly against this travesty. This professor emphasized that the fact that must be faced, incredible as it may seem, is that by legalizing the sale and importation of contraceptives, the government was inevitably opening the door in due time to the legalizing of abortion, of divorce, and what he said many people might find far-fetched at the time, even euthanasia. Of course, it is now easy to see how prophetic these concerns were, in that we now have abortion legislation, divorce legislation, and the campaign for euthanasia and the killing of terminally ill unborn children is at an advanced stage. Even this professor could not have imagined same-sex so-called marriage. He then says, "Our traditional Irish Christian faith cannot ultimately survive if our Christian ethos is undermined and our Christian way of life demoralized as a result of the passing of legislation which facilitates contraception and opens the way to the legislation of abortion and other evils. If that should come to pass, the question must be asked, and it will be asked by future generations of Irish men and Irish women," that's us, "how far the loss of our Christian faith must ultimately be laid at the door of the Irish bishops of the time, who in 3 statements on the proposed legislation on contraception, issued after their statement on Ireland and Europe, failed to express their disapproval of the proposed legislation and provide their people and legislators with the lead which they needed. The question is, why did the bishops not express disapproval of any legislation? Either they approve or they disapprove of it. Presumably on this issue they cannot be credited with a blank mind, nor we hope with a divided one. notwithstanding a fairly common belief that some Irish bishops favour unacceptable views concerning the church's teaching on contraception or its force. Unquote. That was 1978. And look at what has come to pass in this once Catholic country of ours. It should make us weep. But it gets worse. In the 1980s, one of the most vocal of the dissenting professors stationed in the Maynooth Seminary, a priest and a moral theologian, the same one who taught falsely to the Irish Medical Union and was corrected by his archbishop, was appointed by the Irish bishops as secretary to the Catholic Marriage Advisory Council, now Accord. The erroneous teachings were now to be passed to the young engaged Catholic couples in Ireland through the Irish bishops' pre-marriage courses. I did mine in Galway in 1988, where they went through all the various types of contraception with us, and we were even offered advice on the contraceptive pill. I spoke with a married woman I met at a talk I gave in Waterford 2 weeks ago, and she told me that they were shown samples of all the different contraceptives on their Catholic pre-marriage course. We kept in touch with the priest who conducted our pre-marriage course for a while, and after our third child was born, during a phone conversation with my wife, he told her that we could use condoms on account of the 3 cesarean sections that my wife had. This priest has since left the priesthood and is now married with 3 children of his own. This is not surprising. Another priest told her that it was time she talked to her doctor about birth control. Shortly after that, when we had moved to another parish, where the parish priest was reckoned by some to be one of the top 3 theologians in Ireland, you can imagine my wife's surprise when he told her that he did not have a problem with sterilization, where the couple decided that they did not want or need any more children. This was rural Ireland, and this shows you the corruption and dissent that affects many of our priests. It is very interesting to note that in the Garden of Eden, the serpent approaches Eve first. Each of these 3 priests spoke to my wife about contracepting. None of them spoke to me. The final case I want to look at concerns a young married woman with more than 3 children who approached me at a book launch that I was involved in 2009 with Patrick McChrystal. And Patrick will confirm this story. The book in question showed the damage that contraception does within marriage. This young woman was struggling in trying to cope with the demands of her family life and needed to take a break from becoming pregnant. She wanted to uphold church teaching, but had found that natural family planning didn't seem to work for her. Her husband was not opposed to using contraception, and so she sought the advice of a priest. The priest told her that in her case, it was okay to use contraception. So she went to another priest, and another, and another. In all, she told me that she had gone to 6 priests, and that each one of them told her that it was okay to contracept. Why would a woman in this situation keep going to different priests? Her sensus fidei told her that these priests were wrong, and she was obviously looking for support in trying to live her marriage according to church teaching. Finally, in desperation, she wrote to her bishop. Her bishop responded by telling her that he had sent her letter to what he described as one of Ireland's leading theologians and had asked him to address her concern. The theologian in question was none other than the heretical former professor priest from Maynooth, whose own archbishop had written against his opinions in 1970, the same professor who was appointed to the Catholic Marriage Advisory Council in the 1980s, despite his public dissension from Humana Vitae. This priest was retired from active ministry, yet still the bishop sought out his opinion, even though he has publicly dissented from Humana Vitae since its release in 1968. The young woman then showed me the letter from the former professor, and in it he told her that she could use whatever contraception her doctor recommended, the sole proviso being that she should avoid anything that was abortifacient in nature. The young woman had begun to use the pill and condoms subsequent to receiving this letter. This case highlights just how far the church in Ireland has fallen. Here we have a young woman, a wife and a mother, who is trying to live out her life according to the infallible teachings of the church on marriage. Herself and her husband do not see eye to eye on this matter, and so she looks for support, firstly from the clergy. After their betrayal of her marriage, she seeks support from her bishop, only to be betrayed again. There was no need for the bishop to forward her letter to a theologian. The bishop, after all, had been granted the authority to teach and to uphold the deposit of the faith in his diocese. But this bishop, rather than supporting this young woman and her husband, denied the teachings of the church and passed the problem over to another priest who was publicly known for his dissent from church teaching on the matter. The bishop failed in his duty to uphold church teaching. Think for a moment upon the damage this bishop's actions have done to this young couple's marriage. A wife seeks to live her life according to the rule of Jesus Christ. But now her husband can say to her, the priests disagree with you, the theologian disagrees with you, even the bishop disagrees with you. How can you be right and all of them wrong? In this case, the bishop and the theologian perverted right order and introduced corruption into the marriage of a couple who sought their guidance. I am of the opinion that this is not a rare case. The majority of Irish Catholics no longer accept church teaching with regard to contraception, and it is my belief that the majority of our priests no longer accept this teaching either. I would not yet go so far as to say that the majority of our bishops disagree with this teaching, although I would not be surprised if that were the case. But I will say that none of our bishops have taken any public action to eradicate the false teaching that was promoted by the Catholic Marriage Advisory Council and which is still being promoted by Accord, the renamed Marriage Advisory Council, today. When the Irish bishops failed to prevent heretical priest professors from spreading their errors on marriage within the seminary in Maynooth, they allowed a cancer to go untreated and to spread. They also undermined their own teaching authority. For if no correction was forthcoming for those who publicly dissented from church teaching, it stands to reason in the layman's mind there cannot be any problem with the dissenters' opinions. Otherwise, the bishops would have corrected them, wouldn't they? This magazine, Our Family, was written and produced by an American couple who came to Ireland in 1979 with their 6 children, at the invitation of one of our bishops to help to establish and to promote natural family planning education centers. They thought they were coming to the land of saints and scholars, but they soon realized that the faith in Ireland was being seriously undermined by dissent. The magazine and its author were attacked quite publicly and slanderously by another priestly publication in Ireland, particularly after the author dared to criticize a sex education program that was being promoted in one diocese. This copy is from November to December 1989. That they are good people can be seen from the advertisement on the back of the magazine. It's for Father Paul Marx's book, Confessions of a Pro-Life Missionary. In order to highlight the seriousness of the problem, I want to quote to you from page 36 of this magazine. He's referring to an issue of The Wanderer. And he says, in the same issue, America's best-known Orthodox moral theologian, John Kipling, argued that pedophilia resulted from dissent against Humanae Vitae. It is a startling thesis, but he makes his case well. If he is right, this is November 1989, if he is right, we can expect priestly pedophilia to become an issue in Ireland as time goes by. The sad prophecy was fulfilled 10 years later. Last year, 1.2 million voters, the vast majority of them baptized Catholics, voted to allow 2 men or 2 women to pretend to marry each other. And they inserted this into our Constitution. Our Constitution is now a blasphemous document, for it declares that in the name of the Most Holy Trinity, a man can marry a man and a woman can marry a woman. So what is the solution to this problem? St. Maximilian Kolbe tells us, in the face of such strong attacks by the enemies of the Church of God, are we to remain inactive? Is that all we can do? Complain and cry? No. Every one of us has a holy obligation to build a trench and personally hurl back the assaults of the enemy. Unquote. The solution to these problems lies with the fathers of families building a trench in which his family can become holy and prosper for the glory of God and the building of his kingdom. Pope St. John Paul II said in Familiaris Concertio, where this conference gets its name, the future of the world and of the church passes through the family. As a Benedictine oblate, I was recently struck once again by chapter 2 of the Rule of St. Benedict concerning the role of the abbot. Fathers, listen up here. Let the abbot be ever mindful that at the dreadful judgment of God, an account will have to be given both of his own teaching and of the obedience of his disciples. And let him know that to the fault of the shepherd shall be imputed any lack of profit which the father of the household may find in his sheep. Fathers, as head of the family, you have a duty to lead your wife and children to heaven, and you will be accountable to God for how you handle this grave responsibility. Make sure that you know what is required of you and that you know what it is you are called to do to protect and to guide your family. Father Matteo Crawley Boevi, the great apostle of family enthronement to the Sacred Heart of Jesus Christ as King of Family Homes, once, while commenting on the destruction of cathedrals and churches after the Second World War, said, "How much more appalling is the moral ruin of this thrice holy sanctuary, which is the home. Basilicas and cathedrals, however magnificent and venerable they be, will not redeem the world, but holy families will do so. This is logical, for the family is the source of life and the first school of the child. Hence, if the font is poisoned, the nation will perish." There is so much more to say, but let me finish on this note, particularly for fathers and mothers. Get the Catholic family right, and right society will follow. Get the Catholic family right, and abortion will be conquered. Get the Catholic family right, and divorce will go. Get the Catholic family right, and there will be no need to kill off our old people through euthanasia. Get the Catholic family right, you will reduce the suicide rate. Get the Catholic family right, and you will get an increase in vocations to priestly and religious life. Get the Catholic family right, and the number of people afflicted with same-sex attraction will decline, and those that do suffer from this affliction will be properly cared for and encouraged to live chaste lives. It is not the responsibility of the bishops to get particular families right, nor the responsibility of the state. It is the responsibility of Catholic fathers to get their Catholic family right. With God's help, let us do it, and let us transform and heal this society of ours so that once more the face of Christ will radiate from this once proud Catholic nation of ours. Thank you very much.